other reflections from the hike that you want to share?
I thought it was cool how all the different habitat zones we walked through, and how quickly they changed, and how distinct they were. That's cool, you know. I don't know why I think that's cool, but I think the sheer variety out here, you know, the small scale of the changes out here, so it's so great. And that sort of goes against the idea of woods as a crop. You know, you're going to have tremendous mixture and variety stuff out here, but I won't go on anymore.
It's certainly not a monoculture. It's, you know, and the 20th century was all about monocultures in forests and on farms.
Yep.
And a lot of farmers these days are appreciating, yeah, maybe we should have the potatoes here and the wheat over there.
I was wondering if you could...
Oats around here are very, very simple. There are not much, no, we could have a few kinds of trees up here. That's about it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of variety without a whole lot of species. It's cool. It's something to think about.
Wondering if you could expand or comment a bit about the change in philosophy after Pasquale, where they tried to defund the Forest Service and, you know, a lot of that stuff that they blamed on some of the bad forest fires and all that. But do you have any comments on the history after he was gone and what followed up as a pushback away from that?
So you're thinking of the forest fires of 1910?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pinchot, I believe, was still running the Forest Service at that time. He had often struggled with this brand new agency to get people to understand what it was going to do. And then with the big burn of 1910, Missoula all the way across the Idaho Panhandle, huge, huge forest fire, suddenly people understood that these foresters were going to protect the forest. Pinchot, like many scientists of the era, like many people of that era, viewed fires as destructive. These days we see them as part of an ecosystem process that helps sort of recycle nutrients into the ground, and in the long term they can be healthy for forests. But at the time, forest fires were one of the biggest concerns of wasting resources. How can we let these trees burn and we don't get to use them? Well, if we have foresters who can put out forest fires, then that expenditure, that government expenditure, will actually bring back more in dollars, because we will save trees that we'll be able to use. The Forest Service, especially in the 20s and 30s, became famous for trying to put out every forest fire before 10 a.m. the next day, or maybe it was noon. And there's ecological explanations for that. You know, you want to catch the fire before the heat and dry air get to where they're going to really make it explode. But I kept thinking about Gifford Pinchot's desire to answer all of his letters before 10 a.m. the next morning. Let's take care of that management issue that arose yesterday, early, so that we can get going on our goals. And I think with the fires in 1910, there became a much more enthusiasm about the Forest Service. And Timothy Egan's book, The Big Burn, I think it's called, is a great chronicle of that, and of Pinchot and Roosevelt working together, and of the fellow named Pulaski who invented the Pulaski tool that foresters now use. I think in a sense that was the peak of Pinchot's career. It was 10 or 11, when he got in the fight with William Howard Taft, the president, and he got fired. And they brought in more and more, frankly, I think it was a lot of German or German-educated foresters who tended to see more of a resource-based approach to the forest. Even by the 20s, Pinchot was a little bit aggravated with the direction of the Forest Service. They were too much technicians involved in tree cutting. He still loved the agency. And in the 30s, there was a proposal to sort of merge national forests and national parks, but they would be under Park Service Administration in the Department of Interior. And Pinchot loved his Forest Service too much to imagine it going under. So was that the sort of things you were, you must have read Egan's Big Burn. It's a great
book. There was a big power struggle as which direction to go, and it was really a philosophy struggle at the heart of it, I think, a philosophy of Forest Service, would you agree?
Yeah, right, well said. Good, other reflections, yeah.
Well, you asked earlier how you could make it a more democratic process, and it seems that for the process to work, people have to participate in democracy. So if you think about in the 80s, you know, the Northwest was getting totally logged until people got involved, right, and said, wait a minute, the greater good is not these lumber mills. And that's happened localized in lots of places. I mean, if we battle it here in Montana, what is the greatest good of our forest? But where people get involved, I think that's the biggest thing we can do is participate in democracy.
Participate and do so in an educated way, understanding.
That's right, understand the issues.
I think this was a question that John Muir really never had to grapple with. You know, whenever he went hiking, he just carried a hunk of bread that he'd bought at the grocery store at home. He was not, you know, we think of him as a wilderness person. He wasn't a forager. He wasn't a hunter-gatherer. He didn't collect berries. He did just sort of, he knew, intuitively, he knew which landscapes could be sacrificed, if you will, and which were important. He knew he never really tried to codify that because he wasn't the kind of person who codified things.
Can you explain that? Which landscapes could be sacrificed?
So Muir believed that certain landscapes were valuable in their holistic beauty and they should not be altered, managed by humans. And yet he always used the products of landscapes from elsewhere that had been altered and managed by humans. And he just sort of assumed that you could tell that Yosemite was in the first category and the orchard that he managed in Martinez, California on San Francisco Bay was in the second category. And it would have been great if someone had said, you know, can you explain how what the criteria are for these two categories? But he wasn't sort of that top-down, logical, categorizing kind of thinker.
You know, that's the real problem I think we all face now. You know, there's so damn many of us, and we need all these products,
right.
And we have to manage stuff. But at the same time, we see all the beauty around us. And you know, how the hell do we figure out how to balance that stuff? In my case, you know, I wouldn't want anywhere. But that's me, and I know that's impractical. But there's, you know, I don't want to stream. Other lots of people are, but there's no. I can't figure out how to identify a center point, you know, an optimum. And that's I think I'm not a philosopher, but I think that's a big problem of our time. If I were a philosopher, that's what I'd be after. But this place here, you know, it's you could potentially harvest some trees up here. You know, I look at there's a patch of woods up here that looks like it's one of those main ponderosa pine stands ever, but you're not going to for probably economic reasons. It just wouldn't be worth the effort. But there are lots of places where the beauty is there. But so when do we decide? That's a terrible problem for me. I can't get a hold of it.
It was a problem for Muir and Pinchot in their time and for the country in their time. And I think that's a great segue into our next topic. I mentioned that I was interested in writing a book because I read about this encounter between Muir and Pinchot at Lake McDonald in Glacier. I imagined the preservation and conservation philosophies colliding there. Pinchot may be looking and saying, well, you know, we could cut those trees first, and if you put the dam here, and Muir would be like, no, no, don't touch any of it, it's sacred. That conflict really played out in a famous way at a place called Hetch Hetchy, which is part of Yosemite National Park. It's a smaller, more remote valley, but somewhat similar to the main Yosemite Valley, had some of the same qualities. And the city of San Francisco said, if we could put the dam right there, we could build a reservoir for all of the people of San Francisco. San Francisco had just been through a huge fire when they had really needed water to fight fire. San Francisco is on a shallow peninsula that doesn't have a lot of natural water features. San Francisco had all of their domestic water was supplied by a private company that was gouging people for water rates. If they could have a publicly owned water system, this would be the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run. And they went to Gifford Pinchot and explained that philosophy, and he said, yeah, that's a great idea. You've got a million people, half a million, whatever the population was then, in San Francisco who need drinking water, and you've got maybe 2 or 3 dozen people visiting the Hetch Hetchy Valley every summer because it's so remote. This is the utilitarian approach. I will support you. And John Muir said, no, it's a national park. Where are our criteria for preservation? We have established national parks as the places that we are not going to touch, that we are not going to muck up. You can't build the dam there. Muir wrote to Theodore Roosevelt, the president, and Roosevelt said, John, I love you. You took me on a tour of Yosemite that was amazing. I learned so much. I want to support you. I need some evidence that other people believe what you believe. And he said, surely if people were educated, 90% of them would agree with me. But how is he going to educate everybody? He wrote lots of letters. He got the Sierra Club behind him. But there were some Sierra Club members who were politicians, statesmen in San Francisco or Oakland city government who said, This is a pretty nice deal, and I've never been to Hetch Hetchy. What do I gain from this spiritual value? And so, indeed, these philosophies clash. Now, in my experience doing events like this, we've never walked like this or had a philosopher involved, but I find that people sort of lean one direction or another. So as our sort of exercise, I want to suggest that we split up, that we choose teams. That if you're really into the spiritual, holistic, natural preservation, maybe you gather over here. And if you're more into the conservation, sustainability, management, you gather over here. Now, I realize lots of people feel somewhat one way and somewhat the other, and just, it's an exercise. Choose teams.
Yep.
Have some fun.
Yeah, so actually, if we can get up and...
If you haven't had enough exercise yet, let's actually get up and move into to the right or the left.
Yeah, and then what we'll do, John's going to be the caller and name off certain activities, and this will be a gut-level exercise, because obviously we won't have time to fully deep dive into these, but just what your gut level is when he names off of a certain activity. We'll say this one right now just for giggles is conservation, and over here is preservation.
Oh, that's backwards of what I was saying.
Oh, sorry. conservation, preservation. All right. And so he'll call off one, and if you feel fairly comfortable where you're at, stay. And if you feel gut level that you might be inclined more the other direction, then you'll go to that side. So I kind of...
I got him listed here.
So just how do you define the difference between
now exactly? So, you like national parks better? You're a preservationist. You like national forests better? You're a conservationist. If you're into the spiritual values, if you're a poet, if you love John Muir's writing, you hang out over here. If you're into management and efficiency and fairness for everybody, you're probably a Pinchot person over here. Does that help?
And of course, we're talking extremes, and there's some.
Right, I realize a lot of you will want to be in the middle, but it's fun to put to choose sides.
Go ahead of here. I didn't know if that was.
Yeah, no, I've got it here.
You got it.
Think,
okay, so. Cool. All right.
It's, I love it. I love it. We have husband and wife splitting up. This happens almost every time I do this. This will generate discussion for you guys, not just in the next hour, but for weeks ahead. So, how do you feel about grazing on public lands? For it? Against it? For it? Against it?
Up to a point.
And so some of you in the middle who are against it, you might want to start leaning over here. How do you feel about logging on public lands in general? Should we have more logging on public lands?
Then you'd go over here.
If you want less logging on public lands, maybe over there. Mining.
Solid. Not moving.
Mining on public lands. What about trail development on public lands? We're all here on these trails that were developed on.
What kind of trails?
Well, okay, right. Hiking trail. Does it make a difference if it's a hiking trail or a motorized trail?
Yes.
Or a bike trail.
What do we do about, let's say there's a forest fire in a remote area. Do we fight it?
If we fight it, then you'd stay over here.
If we believe in managing nature, then we need to fight at least some of our forest fires. If we don't want to manage, maybe we're more preservationists. Does it matter whether that fire...
Are so, you're presenting them as black and white.
Oh, yes.
And it's like they're never black and white.
They're never
it's
black
okay.
and white.
Okay, some forest fires, I think they should burn. Some of them, put them out. Like, okay. Where do I go?
Well, and so here's maybe another question, too, which was going to follow. Does it matter if the fires were caused by lightning versus cigarettes?
It's more, for me, it's more location.
Okay. So as opposed to cause.
Muir's position on fire, I thought he was against fire.
I was not able to find Muir talking much about forest fires. Okay. I'm not quite sure what he would have said. He in general did not need for nature to be managed, so he might be in favor of letting them go. Certainly his successors as preservationists believing in ecosystem processes are like, if we can let it go, let's let it go. We don't want to, we want to fight as little as possible.
So how do you balance letting it go and carbon?
And carbon and contributing our carbon footprint.
Right? How do you balance those two things? You can be all over there on carbon and letting it go in the two don't match.
Yes. These issues are complex. If someone knows more science than me, there could be something about the cycles of carbon that it's not. A forest fire may not be as bad as other forms of burning carbon, but I don't know enough about the science of
nature.
Big fire. I mean, yeah, I'd assume that the carbon from the forest fire is still going to be way less than what we produce just as humans. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
yeah, it gets recycled into the environment somehow. It becomes available more easily for to become new trees.
Yeah, the problem nowadays is that, you know, I'm all for letting them burn, but except we've been putting them out for so long that everything is much more combustible now, and if let them burn now, and they're much more combustible than it would have been if we hadn't tried to put them out for so long. And so we've got to put them out now. And such, you know, like the Ponderosa pine woods, they're sustained by, you know, fairly frequent fires. I'm not sure what it was around here, but... You see, what, every 15, 20, 30, 50 years, now we can't let that happen naturally because it's all houses up here. And so we have to put them out. And you get, you know, stuff like all that dog food stuff over there anywhere else. I don't know. Again, it's great. You know, I lean toward the near side, but I have to, you know, I'm off the gray when it comes down to real life.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I feel that way too.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about Glacier Park and why part of the reason I love it so much and want it protected is because I've experienced it so much. So I don't necessarily feel as passionate about protecting an area I've never been to, and I'm less likely to get involved in the democratic process if something's happening in a place where I haven't made a connection to.
Yeah, and it raises an interesting point, too, if we're wanting to protect more things and you've never had the experience of, like, the idea that you're bound to protect things more that you love, and you love things, typically, that you know. And so how do you bridge that gap of introducing and
right.
educating and allowing people to experience
I've been thinking about zoos and how, like, inner-city people experience zoo animals and then might care more about what happens in other parts of the world where habitat is.
Yeah.
Although nobody's been to Hetch Hetchy in 100 years, and it still comes up in the Bay Area, like, why don't we take that dam down?
Well, what was... So, I mean, I do think there's an important point just to return to. None of these are black and white issues. They're very gray. They fall on the spectrum, and so these ideas of where do we fall, preservation, conservation, and what manifestation of that are much more complicated than our either-or scenario, and having to play those out in politics and is a tough one.
But I do think that many people, we have a personality that leans one way or the other, that we lean towards the poetry and mysticism of Muir, or we lean towards the management and fairness of Pinchot. And so all of these, yes, very complicated environmental issues that come up are often shaped by our leanings one way or the other. And we have a tendency to portray the other side as extreme. And so the disciples of John Muir could look at, I mean, they literally looked at Gifford Pinchot and said, John Muir died a year after the Hetch Hetchy decision. You guys killed our hero. And the Pinchot people might look at Muir, at the defenders of the pristine Hetch Hetchy Valley, and say, you guys were the ones who were going to keep drinking water from the poor people of San Francisco. And so there's this tendency always to demonize the other side in its extreme form. And yet, as we're seeing, as people keep migrating towards the middle, we all do tend to migrate towards the middle.
It actually, you saying that makes me think of an experience I had when you asked us to think about use, respect, and manage when we were coming down here. And I realized sort of in that I have a bit of cognitive dissonance. I think I have an emotional lean toward preservation, but an intellectual lean
mm-hmm.
toward conservation.
Right.
And those two are at struggle within me, I think,
yeah.
In a lot of ways. Because I think on one hand, when I think about the word respect, it's from an emotional standpoint, it's hard for me to put use and manage in the same bucket as respect. But intellectually, you most certainly can. And so there's this constant interplay between those two, at least for me, in my experience.
Yeah, and I think for most of us. I mean,
yeah.
for me, you know, John Muir was a preacher's kid who moved to the mountains for the spiritual experience. I'm a preacher's kid who moved to the mountains. Gifford Pinchot was a product of the congregational religion in New England, who studied forestry and economics in college. I was a product of Congregationalists, and I studied economics in college. I'm torn both ways, as many of you are as well. And the wonderful thing for me in the story of Muir and Pinchot is that it turns out they were torn in those two ways as well. That when they met on the shores of Lake McDonald, I went into researching that episode expecting to find them fighting, arguing. Oh, this will be a great book. I can show them arguing all the time. And instead, they got along great. Muir was able to talk about the natural setting And Pinchot was able to convince Muir to go fishing. You know, Muir loved animals, didn't like killing animals, didn't have a very large appetite, never bothered to go fishing, but with Pinchot there on that beautiful lake, they went fishing together. Muir told lots of stories of his wanderings. Pinchot listened and thought about how he could incorporate those spiritual values in his life. And they talked about how to manage these landscapes. And so one of the remarkable things, I sort of hid why were they there? Why was Muir in Helena? He was in Helena on his way to Glacier. Pinchot was in the Seeley Swan on his way to Glacier because they were part of a committee called the National Forest Commission. Although Pinchot founded the Forest Service in 1905, forests had been set aside starting in 1891. And the problem was that the government said, yeah, clearly this needs to be, we don't want to homestead these lands, let's set them aside as forest reserves. But we don't really know what to do with them. We don't know what the laws should be. We don't know whether they should be preserved or conserved. We don't, Congress actually had no guidance on how to manage these lands. And eventually the land managers said, unless you give us some guidance, we're just going to not let anyone allow anyone on these lands at all. So all of your public lands had no trespassing signs. It makes no sense, right? How can public lands, how can the public not be allowed on public lands? And they assembled this commission to decide on a philosophy for public lands. And lo and behold, Muir and Pinchot were able to agree that there is value in holding lands publicly. I believe this is Forest Service land, but whether it's Forest Service or BLM or Park Service, the whole notion of public lands was brand new in the 1890s. The only reason the government had previously owned land was to give it away to homesteaders or to railroad companies. And now the government was saying, we democratically are going to hold on to some of these lands in perpetuity. And we democratically are going to decide what the priorities should be for those lands. And even though Muir and Pinchot might have slight disagreements about those priorities, they were able to come together to defend the broader picture. And really, public lands were in such rough shape in 1895, 6, 7, that there was the potential for them to disappear entirely. That the Congress was looking at passing a law saying, yeah, you just need to sell all those lands or turn them over to homesteaders. We cannot make the notions of a Forest Service or a Park Service work, and so we're not going to own any land whatsoever. And this National Forest Commission successfully lobbied for an 1897 law that established management philosophies for public lands. And it was a combination, I believe, of Muir's rhetorical gifts, as he wrote basically op-eds in favor of this law, and Pinchot's managerial genius, as he took a job in 1897 with the federal government looking at how to manage these lands. It was that combination of their rivaling perspectives that gave us the public lands legacy we have today.
Yeah. So I've been thinking that it's been a bit unfair to characterize this as sort of utilitarian versus spiritual, and then you brought up a word that I think is super important in the whole discussion, and that's economics, because so much of those decisions get made for economic reasons rather than utilitarian or spiritual reasons. And Hetch Hetchy is a good example, because it would certainly be possible to build a water system for San Francisco without damming Hetch Hetchy. But Hetch Hetchy was probably one of the easiest and cheapest ways of doing it. And so it's not merely kind of Muir versus Pinchot. Once you throw economics into it, then all sorts of problems come up.
Yeah, I mean, I would be tempted to say that, you know, there is an argument that choosing the cheapest valley to dam is the greatest good for the greatest number, because you don't have to tax people extra in order to pay for the dam, depending on how you value the things that are being dammed.
Right, but unless you compare the cost. If I'm paying $1 in taxes to dam Hetch Hetchy, maybe I'll pay $5 in taxes to build this network of small lakes instead. I mean,
I agree, but the question is who decides?
Yeah.
Who knows how much you're willing to pay or I'm willing
right.
to pay?
But you can't just say the cheapest is necessarily the best either.
Right. I absolutely do agree.
One of the things you asked us to think about was the word respect. And I actually took an ethics course from Thomas Bymaster, and it changed my mindset about the respect of other organisms. The respect of a tree, that you know, living organisms have the right to thrive, just like humans or other mammals, for example. And I think that if we, as a society, had a deeper respect, then issues like should I spend $1 or $5 would be part of our discussion, because we would look at the respect aspect of other organisms, even non-mammal, non, you know, what we call living. But that process for me was a long process until I got that shifted mindset. And I wonder how we could do that in society. It's not just educating people about the science. It's going beyond that.
Maybe if I could respond to that in one way. I think your comment's spot on, and one of the things that reminds me of was a walk that Henry Kramer did, I think it was last year. And he, a lot of his area focuses in phenomenology, and has done some work with David Abram, who does a lot of work in that field. But kind of looking at the idea of how we experience nature, having this shift, not necessarily learning about something, but education from that sense, but learning from something, and having the shift where it's rather than looking at something as an object, we look at it as a subject. And that's at least a beginning platform to make that move, perhaps, to the respect element from a different angle. That's just something I thought about. I don't know if anyone else has thoughts about that. But.
I think we need not only scientific education, but philosophical education.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you for bringing us out here, and thank us all for coming.
And on that note, actually, I'm thinking timing-wise, just to make sure we get back in time, we might want to do some prompts just to think about on the way back the other situation, since we're talking about contrasting philosophies. And is there something, and I can certainly just say those too.
Okay. Let me wrap up by saying that we've been setting this up a lot in terms of conflict. I talked about Muir at one spot and then about Pinchot at another spot. We talked about Hetch Hetchy as a conflict. And yet, to me, in the end, the conflict is counterproductive. The conflict is not what we want to focus on. What we want to focus on is ways to get beyond conflict. That was what was exciting to me about Lake McDonald, was Muir and Pinchot found ways to get beyond their conflict. So this has been a great discussion, and we're going in lots of interesting ways, but I do want to sort of highlight that as one of the take-home messages, is are there ways that we can avoid or mitigate conflicts in philosophy?
And I guess one question, just as a matter of distinction, do you feel that there's a difference between conflict and contrast? So ideas...
Right.
And so maybe looking, because it seems like Muir and Pinchot had certainly contrasting ideas, and maybe in ways they also they conflicted, but they had a lot of shared territory as well.
Right. They disagreed, they had arguments, but they didn't let those arguments define them. They were able to find where they did have common ground and move forward on that, build structures in which they could disagree productively.
So one of the questions that popped into my head when we were thinking about this and preparing, and I think just as a matter of time, this will be something just to think about as we walk back to our starting spot, and it's on building on this idea of contrasting philosophies. But I'm wondering if there's something about bringing contrasting philosophies like Muir and Pinchot together that might yield or offer us something in terms of supporting the common good, that bringing two complementary ones, two similar ones together might not. Like, is there value in bringing two contrasting ways of experiencing and approaching the world, and can that give us something different than just two ones that think the same? So just maybe something to think about, and even expanding it beyond discussions about public lands to other areas.
Hegel. Hegel.
Yes, Hegel. Yes, that was Hegel making it. That's right. So we will continue.